My name is Don. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Don.
I'm already uncomfortable because I don't like the setup of the room. That's the way it is. If you don't either, because this isn't a lecture, give some thought as to how we might rearrange this. We can't possibly get a circle, which is the ideal, because it's the only real thing there is full circle. But perhaps there's some things we can do at the break or something that'll rearrange it so we can get closer to each other. More people can see other people's eyes. If we can do that, we'll do it. And if we can't, well, we just can't. I don't like this at all. I can promise you this will be gone pretty soon. I don't know what we'll do with the microphones, just tape them to our shoulders or something. There, that's all the bitching I'm going to do for the weekend.
No, it's not.
No, but from here on, it's going to be subtle, Jerry.
Oh, okay.
Didn't you hear Tom?
Yeah.
I am an alcoholic. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and have been continuously sober since December 26th of 1967 because there is a God. No other reason. My home group is a little group known as an AA group. That's how we're registered. In naming the group, we saw in the long form of the third tradition, it said that any two or more alcoholics gathered for sobriety may call themselves an AA group. So that's what we call ourselves. And we're not smart, but we're cute. Our central office was not going to allow us to register under that name. They said, you can't do that. And then we reminded them who works for who, and we're registered that way. One of the things we'll probably cover this weekend is who's responsible for this deal. Because it's you and me. We are totally responsible for everything that happens in Alcoholics Anonymous because we are Alcoholics Anonymous. So anything that happens, if I wasn't there and I don't like it, I don't get to say anything about it till I step forward and get wherever it happened next time. But we'll go off into that. We'll let these guys introduce themselves, and then we'll get on about the business at hand.
Thank you. I love people from Alabama because they talk as slowly as I do.
We don't know why he's here, but he's here.
I don't know why I'm here. I heard it was something about damage control. Am I next, too?
You're next.
I'm an Al-Anon from Alabama, and my name's Bo Templins.
Hi, Bo.
Hi. And I live down in a little old town in Alabama called West Blockton. And the best way I can describe that to you is it's right across the highway from East Blockton. And that's just the way that is. It's out in the middle of the woods. And I walked in the doors of Al-Anon September the 4th, 1982, and have been an active member of Al-Anon since that time. One of the greatest things that happened to me early in my journey is that I was introduced to an open AA big book study where they actually allowed Al-Anons to come in and sit in and be a part of the big book study. And it wasn't a big book reading, it was a big book study. And as a matter of fact, one of the first arguments my wife and I had, because she was over there in that AA room, she's been sober for 21 and a half years. And one of the things the old guy would do that was chairing that big book study is every Monday night when it was over, he'd throw out a question. And you had to come back the next Monday night and not just give him the answer to the question, but tell him what page and where it was in the book. And we'd get home and we had one big book. And that happened to be Shirley's. And she let me know that. And so in a very short period of time, I had my own big book. And been eternally grateful for that. I have, for the first 20 years of my journey, I had old-time sponsors. One of them since died, and the other one is very, very ill. And by old-time sponsors, I mean they raised me in the textbook, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believe in that book, and I believe in the AA program. So I don't know why I'm here either. But but I sure am proud to be here this weekend and to be associated with this elite pair that we have over here. That, so with that, I'll pass it right back. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, sir.
Years ago, I used to go to a thing called Happy Hour.
Thank you.
Where you got two for the price of one. This reminds me a bit of that. And I know any time that I had two in front of me, I was elated. And so I'm quite happy sitting up here. My name is Jerry, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Jerry.
Just get a real little housekeeping out of the way. I am a member of an Alcoholics Anonymous group called The Week That Was, and we meet at 7:30 on Friday night in Manhattan, Kansas. Now, I love to say Manhattan and just stop there, because people then they look at me with a new respect, thinking that I'm from Manhattan. And back home, they know that I mean Manhattan, Kansas. In any event, if you're ever in Manhattan, Kansas on Friday night, and you find yourself with little or nothing to do around 7:30 in the evening, come on by. And we'll entertain you. And I guarantee you, if you're in Manhattan on Friday night, you'll have little or nothing to do. I have, because of God's infinite grace, and I want to say as much as I can this weekend with a great sense of humor, because the fact that I'm even here at all is extremely humorous. I mean, as my story unfolds, you'll see why I can say that. But by God's infinite grace, mixed with a great amount of humor that my God has, I have been continuously sober since January 17th, 1977. And what I want to do this weekend with what little time I have is share with you what it's like living with the Spirit, and yet in such a practical way, because see, when I'm living with the Spirit, I'm a good father. I'm not a real serious father, but I'm a good father. And I'm a dependable father. And when I'm living with the Spirit, my wife knows who's going to make sure that there's air in the tires, and that the oil is changed in the car, and that I might take out the trash when I'm living with the Spirit. Those are practical things. It also means that I will carry in wood for a wood stove that we have. Without saying, hey, honey, I carried some wood in. In late 1976... the best folks could figure out to do with me was to put me into a mental institution for the rest of my life. I was 35 years old, and they truly didn't know what else to do with me. And I'm still amazed that people will allow me to come and see them. I mean, New York, let's face it, for a kid who was born and raised in Kansas, New York is fairly sophisticated. And so to get on a real airplane at a real airport, somebody has paid real money to let a guy that should be in a nut house come out and talk to them is still an amazing treat. It really is. And a part of that treat is that I get to see folks here that I have known now for many years. Some of them I knew up in Rhode Island. Some I know from down in Virginia. Some I know from over here in Queens. Some I've met up in Westchester County. We've got some friends from Harlem that I don't see here this particular weekend, but the weekend's young, and maybe they'll show up. And each time I get to see those folks, I'm touched. I really am. In a very, very special way. And when you all touch me that way, I realize that all my life, this is what I was looking for. So, we can talk about the big book, and we can do this, and we can say on page 39 it says thus and so, and I can pretend to be an expert. And the truth of the matter is, you all touch me in a way. And I am a part of a family because I do some things on a precise spiritual path that makes it possible for me to spend time with you and for you to understand me and for me to understand you, because we do some of the same spiritual exercises. And I tell you what, I still am saddened once in a while when I see people that can't be touched the way one alcoholic can touch another. And because it's just ways we reach one another. And it's just absolutely marvelous. I gave this old man sitting here on my left, I gave him a hat many years ago, and he's still wearing the damn thing. He looks good in it. And then many years later, he gave me a watch, and I thought, I was real touched when he gave me the watch. I thought he gave me the watch because he loved me, because that's why I gave him the hat. And he gave me this watch, and then it dawned on me one day after I just had it for a little bit that he wanted me to use it when I was talking, so I had no one to shut up. But that is the way we do with one another. I got the other day, I here several months ago, I was at somebody's place for a weekend, and I slept in a bed. I always love it when I get to stay in their home, and I slept in a bed, and the pillows that I slept on were just absolutely marvelous. I just couldn't get over the fact that I thought maybe they'd sent off to Sweden and had these pillows flown in or something. I wasn't sure, but they were nice. And so I told my friend, I said, you know, darling, these pillows that you've let us sleep on are just the most comfortable thing. And the other day I got a big box in the mail. I mean, huge box, and it didn't weigh much. And I was trying to figure out what in the world have I ordered that would come in a box that size and doesn't weigh anything. And I opened it up, and of course, there's a set of these darn pillows. And I have slept beautifully for the last four nights as a result of these new pillows. Now you say, wait a minute. That ain't no big deal, but I tell you what, it is a big deal, isn't it? Those are the kind of things that make this a big deal or a nifty deal, whatever you want to call it. And so as this weekend unfolds, I will share with you to the best of my ability, how did I get here? And I'm going to tell you some stories. And most of all, I'm going to try to share with you that greatest of all things, and that is if you want what we have, if you want it. Now, you may not want it. You may not want what we have. But if you do, there's a few little things that you can do, that we do, and you will have an experience, and that experience will be that you will be in touch with the Spirit. And you'll find it absolutely unnecessary to take a drink. I used to hear the old-timers say that, and I got so tired of them saying they have found it unnecessary to take a drink since thus and so. And I thought, Jesus Christ. Can't you find something better to say than found it unnecessary to take a drink? And after almost 28 years, I have discovered there's a real good reason for saying that I have found it unnecessary to take a drink. Because that describes it so absolutely perfectly. I have found it unnecessary to take a drink. And a big part of my life, it was absolutely necessary to take a drink. The practical benefits of living with the Spirit. If we want to kind of set aside some of the esoteric parts of this, just the practical benefits. Part of the practical benefits is my kids call me and they say, Dad, you are so dependable, or predictable. They always call me predictable. Now, I translate that in my head just that, you know, I'm dependable. They call me predictable. But I see that as dependable. And I tell you what, I spent a lot of years where I wasn't dependable. And it's a marvelous deal. And that's a part of being in a condition where I find it unnecessary to take a drink, because I'm now today dependable. I don't have a conscience grinding away at me because I didn't get something done. As we sit here tonight and we share some time with one another, I don't have anything that's undone right now. I don't have anything that's undone at all. And so I can get to be comfortable with you all. Isn't that a marvelous deal just to be comfortable? We went out to dinner, and I was able to have my mind free and clear and be with the people I was with, because everything's done. Everything's done. And I just find that so amazing. See, I spent most of my life where I lived in one or two places, and neither one of them was here. It was last week, last month, 2 hours ago. Something that I should have done, wish I would have done differently, could have done better. But I had some great regret over something in the past. Or I had great fear of what was going to occur 2 hours from now, 2 days from now, 2 weeks from now, 2 months from now. So I was way out ahead of myself. But what I wasn't was I wasn't here. And I wasn't now. And years ago, I was with a guy one night, and he said, aren't we okay here now? And I'll ask you that as we begin this weekend. I will tell you that I am okay right here. I really am. I don't need a drink here. I truly don't. I'm okay here. More importantly, I'm okay now. And I have a hunch that you all are too. That was the very first thing that I discovered. I couldn't have articulated this 27 plus years ago. Could not have articulated, but what happens when I am in the company of an AA group, or another old alcoholic, if you will, is that when I am in their company, I am okay. I always have been. I remember when I first started on this journey, I would go into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would have just a few minutes after I got in there, I'd realize that my mind was beginning to quiet down. My body was beginning to relax, and I'd be okay for a little while. Now, when I left, the noise would start up again. And that's what carried me for a long time, was I'd go back so I could experience what it was like just to be okay for just a little while. Here we are many, many years later, and most of the time, unless I'm out in traffic like you all have here, isn't that wild out there? Oh, boy, we came back across a bridge over here, and I looked back up the street, and I could, for miles and miles, I could see nothing but headlights, one right up against another. When Gerard picked me up, oh, if you haven't ever ridden around town with Gerard, I mean, if you want to have an experience, hook up with a guy by the name of Gerard in here. I saw him come in just a few minutes ago, so I know he's here. Just ride around with him for a little while. I hadn't been in this part of the country for about 10 minutes, and one car hit another one. Bam! We came across that bridge, and I looked at all those lights, and I thought, holy moly. But I'm not out there, I'm in here. And I look out at this crowd and I think, my God, this is a pretty clean-cut a reasonably intelligent-looking bunch of folks. And why would they be here? But I know why. I'm just having some fun with y'all. I know why. But who would have ever thought? Can you remember those last horrid months when you were out there? Anytime I get together for a weekend like this, I believe it's a gift from the Spirit. I always get to think back what it was like that last 3, 4, 5 months before I got here. What it was like. Who would have ever believed that we could go from there to here? From there to here. And like I say, I didn't come in here seeking to connect with the Spirit. That was given to me. I didn't know what I was doing. I really was just trying not to drink. I mean, I had everybody on my case. Really, it was a bad, bad situation. I was 35 years old, 3 kids, a wife, just about to be evicted from my home. Couldn't feed those kids. And that's what it was like for me back in November and December of 1976, this time of the year. And still could not quit drinking. I think back on those days and think, how could we go from there to here? And if I say, well, it's through God's grace. And it is, by the way. But if you don't understand what God's grace is, don't worry about that. I don't understand what God's grace is either. I just know it is. You say, well, what's God like? I don't have a clue, folks. I'd love to tell you. I know what God's infinite power has done for me. I lived in horrible, horrible fear most of my life. Today I don't have to live in fear. And I could go on and on and on and on. Because there's just so much that I have a sense that I want to share with you. And we will. We'll share what needs to be shared and what doesn't need to be shared. We'll run out of time. Okay? Works that way. Besides that, I want to hear this beautiful guy from Alabama. I want to hear you all from time to time. And of course, Don knows how dear he is to me. So I want to listen to him too. Most of all, I think I speak for all of us, and they'll tell you too. We thank you from the very bottom of our hearts that you would do anything like this and include us in it. I mean, I wish there's some way that I had a better command of the vocabulary to where I could certainly and clearly express the deep appreciation and gratitude that I have to be here with you like this. I mean, it's just a marvelous deal. The only way I know how to do that is to give you everything that I brought with me. Hopefully the Spirit will flow through us and I can convey some things to you that at least what they mean to me, and if it creates a resonance for you, that'll be terrific. And with that, I think I will see if we're going to move toward a more structured thing here. I don't know whether we will or not. If I turn it over to Pritz, it won't be structured, I don't think. But it'll be interesting.
Shelby's here.
Yes, he is.
Y'all know Shelby?
G. Shelby.
Of the Birmingham Shelby.
Birmingham.
We get to make fun of him because he asked us to work with him. And then he moved to New York. It seems somehow the people out of Denver who get involved in the Big Book end up missionaries in other far lands. That's just the way it is. I was remiss in not mentioning that my home group meets at 6 o'clock every Friday morning at St. Joseph's Hospital in Denver. Our format is simple. We don't have any ritual at all. We've gone back to the way it was in the beginning. At 6, we get quiet. And when the Spirit moves, somebody says something. We talk about a step, a tradition, and a concept back to back. If it takes one meeting or 1 month, we don't care. We just move. When we're through with one, we move to the other. The first Friday after the first Tuesday, or second, anyway, right after the district meeting or an area assembly, each month that belongs to our GSR and our central office rep. That's their meeting. We are part of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we want to know what's going on. So, and if they take 5 minutes, that's fine. If they take a whole meeting, that's fine. We really have an interchange there because we're part of Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. They don't always like to see us coming to assemblies because we have something to say. Following that meeting, we all go to the cafeteria and have a real meeting or another meeting. Much as I hate to admit it, to this day it hasn't gone away, that in any formal meeting that I attend, I'm only partly listening. The rest of me is thinking what I'm going to say when it's my turn. And I can't help it. It's just the way it is. But over breakfast, we chatter and we talk. So if you got a new person, you come to that meeting, we won't hurt them. If it's in, we'll work with them when we get to the cafeteria. Some remarkable things have happened there. And I'm with Jerry. We're going to talk about this book and the things that are in it, but we're talking to the choir. Some of the stuff that gets left out is what I want to talk about this weekend. After you're already spiritually awake, now what? Okay. Because it's way, way beyond going to another meeting. That's important, but it's not vital anymore. It's important because that's where our work is to be found and where our fellowship with other people begins to happen. But if you're still going to meetings to get, talk to me during the break. Although there are times when I go to a meeting to get, but I don't go to a meeting to get well. I go to get what's at the meeting. Anyway, that's for tomorrow sometime. We've been 12-stepping an old street drunk in the cafeteria for about 6 months. Joe comes down once in a while. This guy, several years ago, while he was drunk, had a car wreck, and now he's almost a permanent resident of the hospital on an outpatient basis. We know he had a car wreck because for years now, or for months now, we've stopped by and we chat with him. He sits by himself, and he pays for his table space. He picks up a bunch of free newspapers and brings them along, and he hands them out to anybody that's willing to stop long enough, and that pays for his space. And we chat with him. He won't come sit with us yet. He has come over and stood at the end of the table and talked with us. Sometimes it takes a while. Well, we really care about this guy, and about, 3 or 4 months ago, he had a grand mal seizure right there in the cafeteria and went over backwards and hit his head on the floor, and of course with head wounds, and his blood went everywhere. I've never seen such a response from the hospital staff. Everybody from the EMTs to the hospital administrator within a minute or two was there dealing with him. Now, he's a friend of ours, but we are also smart enough to know that in a hospital, we're not needed. Okay. All we can do is get in the way. But after they'd cleaned him up, a couple of the nurses came over to us to make sure we were all right. See, they'd been watching us and him and the interaction, and they knew that we were friends and we would be concerned, and they wanted to make sure we were okay. Which brought home to me once again that people watch us. If you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, you need to know they're watching you. Yeah. I didn't take you at face value. I watched you. If you couldn't demonstrate to me something different, I didn't want to hear anymore. I've heard all the words I can stand. But if your words match the way you live, then maybe I'll pay attention to them. Or I'll at least get curious enough to ask you, how the hell did you get that done? And I only ask that of people that I've watched for a while. And it's not because I'm paranoid, but I'm a duck. I'm susceptible to persuasion. If you think it's a good idea, I'm game. Okay. Okay. Got me in a lot of trouble through my life. We talk about having an open mind. My dad, who was a very wise man, said, you want an open mind, but you don't want it so open that everybody who drives by throws their trash in it. So we become a little bit discerning here. My life is none of my business since I surrendered to the God that I understand, but the conduct of my life is entirely my business. And I have to become a little bit discerning. Who do I hang out with? Not very many people. I love most everybody, don't like everybody, don't pretend to. Some folks are just unlikable. Well, I'm sorry. I had a parole officer told me that one time. He said, I'll know you're okay when I can find somebody who's just met you that'll tell me honestly they didn't like you. Because you can't possibly please everybody. And if you try to, it just wore me out. I did not know I was alcoholic when Alcoholics Anonymous came and got me. And I didn't come to you because I didn't know I was alcoholic. Why would I come to you? At the time I came into the fellowship, I was 5.5 months sober, meaning that far away from my last drink or any other kind of chemical. I'm also one of the freaks that came out of Berkeley in the 60s screaming out, where there's dope, there's hope, burn down City Hall. Man, we tried. We just couldn't find City Hall.
There is God.
But I am not a drug addict. And I was certified that. I was certified when I got here as a sociopath type 2, psychopath, and a manic depressive drug addict. And I'm none of those things, although the sociopath comes pretty close to my behavior. But I had to find out. See, I'm one of those who has been around long enough to know that our recovery process, which is found in this book called Alcoholics Anonymous, will work for anyone as long as the foundation is truth. If you don't have a foundation of truth, then it isn't going to work. It'll just frustrate the hell out of you. So on an individual basis, I had to find out, what am I really? And I know I'm an alcoholic who had a multitude of other problems, but I'm an alcoholic. Alcohol wasn't a problem for me. It was a condition of being. And I still have it. I have a body that, if I give it alcohol, instantly demands more alcohol. I had a chance to sponsor a psychiatrist once. Oh, I loved that. I've also gotten a sponsor a warden, and I love that. Tell you all about that, too. Oh, yeah. This psychiatrist is one of the founding psychiatrists of one of the finest alcohol and drug treatment programs in the world, the Pier 1 concept at University Hospital in Denver. Been going for many years now, very successful. He couldn't stay sober, though. He knew too much about alcoholism. It's a real problem for him. And I'm the sponsor at the end of the line, because I only know one thing, how to take you through the steps of the big book, in the hopes that in doing so, and in our sharing, you will awaken spiritually, because I can't get you sober. Maybe we can find the spirit within you, because that will. And if you don't want to do it that way, I'd love to go bowling with you, but don't come at 6 in the morning. I'm not interested. Okay? There are too many people who are. And anyway, I was reading the doctor's opinion to him, because the way I was brought into this and the way I do it is very simple. You show up at my house at 6 o'clock in the morning on a regular basis. And that can be once a week or it can be once every day. I don't care. But it has to be regular. And because I know that your main problem isn't alcohol, it's that you can't read. Well, alcoholics don't know how to read. They read white, and the book is written in black. they interpret, they identify with or relate to. God, how many hours have we wasted trying to relate to things we still don't know anything about? So anyway, I'll just read the big book to you, word for word. Share some of my stories, get you to share some of your stories, because that's what it says to do. And together we will walk on this spiritual journey. And I take it with you. I will not ask you to do anything that I'm not doing currently. And somehow in all that, people seem to stay sober. But I'm in the doctor's opinion with a psychiatrist, and it's pretty simple. It's not that complex. But he isn't getting it. I'm watching it go into his head as information and get lost among all the other information he already has. And he isn't getting it. And I love working with people like that because it has caused me to learn effective prayer. Oh, God. Help. What am I going to say to this guy? Because he's put his life in my hands, and I don't take that lightly. Yeah. And I'm not getting through to him. And Silkworth isn't getting through to him. He's too damn smart. So I'm praying, how can I make this even simpler? And I heard this come out of my mouth. Don, what happens to you after the first drink? He said, oh, around the fourth or fifth or sixth drink, I kind of forget what I am and what I'm supposed to do next, and I end up getting drunk. And I said, well, what happens to you after the first drink? He said, well, around the fourth or fifth or sixth drink somewhere, I lose track of where I am and where I'm supposed to be next, and I end up getting drunk. What happens to me after the first drink is the second drink. That's it. He got it. That's it. What happens to me after the first drink is the second drink. And then he helped me, because you do, you know. It didn't necessarily happen within an hour of the first one. It may be I had a drink on Monday, he said, and it was Thursday before it caught me. And so I learned a little something from him. But it caught him. Somewhere along the way, if when I drink I'm unable to control the amount that I drink, or if when I want to stop I find I can't stop, that defines alcoholism. And he got it. And I got it. Yeah. The Chinese told us this 3,000 or 4,000 years ago. Man takes a drink. Drink takes a drink. Drink takes the man. Alcoholism and the drink taking a drink. Isn't that wonderful? That's ego deflation at depth. We finally have something I cannot control, even with the delusion that I can. I can live in complete fantasy, but I know if once I've accepted the fact that what happens to me after the first drink is the second drink, and that's irrevocable, it does happen, my ego's busted. We're finally on the way. It doesn't take emotional browbeating. My God, that causes me to drink. Can't you see what you're doing to your kids? Oh, yeah. That hurts so bad, I better have a drink. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Don't you see what you're doing to yourself? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I need a drink. I can give you 100 reasons I drank, or more. The main reason I drank is no reason at all. And the ego finds that impossible to accept, and once it accepts it, it's broken. That one little piece of information is the key to our entire recovery process. And Bill says in the big book, any description of alcoholism which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete, and that includes ours. So I offer a challenge to you, because I've already heard it once this weekend. Anytime I say to anyone that the recovery process is in the first 164 pages, I'm lying to them. That leaves out the doctor's opinion. And it leaves out two of the most important sentences in the big book, the first two, which tells people who we are. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who've recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. I don't have any problem at all with people who are still in recovery, but I'm not. I've recovered from alcoholism. All that means is that I don't suffer from any of the symptoms of alcoholism anymore. I suffer a good deal from the human condition. But what are the symptoms of alcoholism as we understand it? Well, if I take one drink, I will take another. A craving will develop that causes me to put everything else secondary. It becomes paramount to all other interests. Well, I don't drink, so I don't have that problem. I don't suffer from that. The other part of my illness is that I can't seem to remember that. I have alcohol on my mind all the time. Well, I haven't thought of a drink or a pill or a fix for 35 plus years. It's gone. It's not there anymore. I am incredibly vulnerable because I don't see alcohol. It has to be brought to my attention. Now, you can either be scared of that or you can accept the fact, as I have, that I must have a power greater than myself watching over me, because that's going to catch me at an odd time. Won't catch me tonight. Won't catch me at 6 o'clock in the morning with my group or somebody I'm working with. I'll tell you exactly when it almost caught me. At 37,000 feet one time. I was coming back from a little deal here in New York, as a matter of fact. I've been in and out of this town a lot. I had the privilege of serving as a delegate from my area and a trustee at large. And so I'm in and out a lot. And I'm headed home after a weekend here that had been pretty good. I hadn't hurt anybody and didn't get pissed at anybody, which was rare, at the board level anyway. And I'm headed home to the family that I love beyond anything I can describe to you. Now and then, because I fly with United a lot, they bump me into first class. I used to think it was because I'd done God's work well and this was my reward.
Sure.
You know, a little spiritual delusions now and then. I talked with a flight attendant once and she said, "No, we're full and we need your seat and we can't resell the first class seat, but we can get you out of yours, we can resell yours." I don't care why they put me up there, it's better than back there. And they serve real food. They use real plates. They even have linen on that little drop-down seat. And real steel silverware. Well, they used to. I was bumped up into first class a few weeks ago, and now you have a steel spoon and a steel fork and a plastic knife. And the thought crossed my mind, that's weird. I wonder if they know what I can do with a fork. Don't tell anybody I said that to them. But anyway, I'm up there in first class, and it's nice. And it's an evening flight, so the lights were kind of dim and the reading lights were on. Gave the room a nice ambiance. Remember that.
I will.
I don't know what it means, but I heard somebody use it the other
write
day.
Write that down.
It sounds great.
Oh, yeah. I'm reading a book I've been wanting to read because I've got a 3.5-hour flight home. Everything was fine. I was emotionally and mentally stable and fit. I was spiritually fit, and that's the third part of my illness. And the main part of my illness, I have a spiritual disease. And it's called separation from. Yeah, that's the disease. That's my real problem. A sense of separation from God and the people about me. Everything we do here is geared to bring us back into line with God and the people about me. Anyway, I was fit. And they started serving supper, and I saw the flight attendant pouring this ruby, beautiful red burgundy stuff into my seatmate's glass, just out of the corner of my eye. And I turned to look at it, because in the light and the way the light was hitting it and all the comfort, it got my attention. And my mind said, that really looks good. Now that's the truth. I think people with long-term sobriety are far more in danger from the truth than they are from lies. Of course it looked good. I didn't see wine. That's not part of my consciousness. Burgundy red stuff, it looks good. Then immediately my mind said, I bet this is going to taste good too. Well, of course it would. Why else would she give it to him? I'm pouring in vinegar. And I'm still not thinking wine. That's just going to taste good. Then my mind went into the knowledge I have about wine without ever thinking about wine and said, I bet that'll make his whole dinner taste better. Because that's one of the main functions of wine for real people. It cuts the grease from what you just ate so you can taste what you're about to eat. And immediately a prayer began in me, and I don't know how else to explain that. The Spirit is alive. Where I am, God is, and the Spirit is alive and well. And there are things that happen for me where I know the Spirit is saying, Yoo-hoo! And that happened, and I immediately withdrew and went inside because that's where I go. And instantly realized my very next thought would have been, I probably should have one of those too, without ever thinking of that as alcohol. That's how vulnerable I am. I must have that Spirit to watch over me because it'll catch me at 37,000 feet without thinking about it. And this book is filled with stories of people who had the same experience with no thought at all. They started drinking again. I don't want to live my life afraid that that's going to happen to me. So I have learned spiritual exercises that keep me focused on something else so that the Spirit, I'm available to the Spirit. That's all I have to be. I get distressed sometimes in the new AA with some of the things I hear. Not all of them, some of them. The one I heard the other day disturbed me a little bit. The chairperson said, let's invite God in. I'm thinking, what? Wait a minute. God's already here. Let's acknowledge that. That little shift makes a difference, you know. It's a shift in thinking that causes. I hear people talk about not being connected anymore. It scares the hell out of me for them. This isn't about being connected to something. It's about acknowledging the presence of. I can't be connected and unconnected from God or I'll live a life of utter anxiety. I don't want to do that. I really trust and rely upon the Spirit. And to do the Spirit's work, I have to because I'm constantly put in conditions where I don't know what the hell to do next. But we have entered into a new world where we just kind of know intuitively how to handle situations that used to baffle us. And the great mercy of that is I usually don't know I've done that for about 6 weeks after I've done it. So I don't get to take any credit for it at all. All I have ever wanted to be was a good father and a good son and a member of my community, and could just never pull it off. And I can't lay that off on I didn't know how, because I did. I come from a functional home. I'm sorry, but I do. Okay. Well, it's not fashionable anymore. As far as I know, I'm the only alcoholic in it. My Uncle Walter looked promising for a while. He and Aunt Ruth used to drink and get drunk and have a ball. They partied all the time. Good, hard drinkers. And then, I don't know, 40 years or so ago, Uncle Walt's doctor said, Walter, if you don't stop drinking, you're going to die. And he quit. Just didn't have what it took. Oh, you got to be tough to be an alcoholic. You got to be tough in every area. You got to be tough enough to sleep in the snow on the street, not freeze to death. You got to be tough enough to lie to the people that you love the most. Got to be tough enough to steal from your children and everybody else around you. This isn't an easy deal. You got to be tough enough. Like Jimmy was tough enough that he drank rubbing alcohol and survived that. You got to be pretty tough to do. He smelled bad, but he made it. And recovery is for tough people, too. The spiritual life is not one for weaklings or sissies. You got to be really tough to live a spiritual life. And I could spend an hour telling you why, and I won't. Maybe we'll chat about some of that. But you've got to be tough. This calls for sacrifice. And in my human condition, in my human mind, I always thought sacrifice meant that I take the person that I love the most and put them on the altar, cut their throat, and give them to God. Well, that's what we're training. Sacrifice is a sacred offering. The whole word traces back to sacred. I offer to God the very best of me. That's all it means. I will give you my very best. And it means I have to understand that that's good enough for God to use. I can no longer play the game that I am not worthy. The hell I'm not. I'm here. And that's all he ever asks. Just show up. So I make a sacrifice. There are nights I'd rather stay home. This is one of them. My wife retired 2 years ago, and my grandchildren are at home tonight, and they're baking cookies. And my wife has gotten cuter in the last 2 years than she was when I married her.
It's true.
It's true.
It is.
And I'm not dead yet. But she and I understand something. The reason we have what we have, and we've been married now, well, we've been together as of December 3rd for 28 years. We haven't had a fight yet. She won't fight. And I won't fight. She's right most of the time anyway. And, she thinks I'm the cutest thing she's ever seen. And I agree. Sacrifice is an important thing because sometimes it does mean there are other things I would like to be doing, but this is more important. And it's described in our book. Just before the third step, it describes spiritual people and their way of thinking. We begin to lose interest in our little plans and designs and think more and more of other people. In several places it talks about it. My thoughts should turn to how I can be of use to you, because that is being of use to me. When I was sick, it was me and who I needed you to be to give me what I thought I needed. I'm no longer sick. I'm spiritually awake, and part of that means that I understand clearly I am you and you are me. And what happens to you happens to me. And what happens for you happens for me. I believe that the spiritual life, truly, in my present state of being, is one of enlightened self-interest. That's the best I can get out of it. I still want mine. I still want to be comfortable and appreciated and loved and wanted and needed. But I've discovered that the best way for me to get mine is to make sure you get yours. And mine comes automatically. And people think this is a hard thing to do. That says I love you. I ain't fighting. Nothing going on here. I'm here tonight because I was invited to come. And my experience of God is just that. All my relationships are based on my relationship with God, and if they're not, I feel it instantly. First thing I learn about God is it comes by invitation only. Not because he's mean, but because if I don't invite, I'm not aware. And it's just about being aware. It comes by invitation only. So I only come by invitation. My worst character defect was my rudeness. My willingness to impose myself and my ideas in your life without asking you whether you wanted me there or not. Okay. Comes every time there's an invitation. Yep, got to fit that one. That one's a bitch. I was taught early on in AA to never turn down a legitimate AA request. Now that sounds simple, but isn't that a bitch? I've got to decide what's legitimate and what isn't. Oh my goodness, how do I figure that out? Well, it isn't that hard. Just say yes to everything that comes by if you got the time. But in time, that changes. I'm going to spend more time in the later part of this book this week because many of you have already been here, and Jerry and I have already covered the ground, and Bo's covered the ground. tell you one thing, then I want to, we'll take a break and give it back to Boy. You want to meet, somebody said we'll quit at 8. I think that's ridiculous. We'll take a break and come back.
Yeah.
I do say yes to most everything because that is what I'm supposed to do. We'll talk later about some of the times when I can, if others are going to be affected, I should consult with them too. That's not just an amend principle, that's a life principle. Okay. About 8-9 months before the event, I was invited to go with another past delegate from our area to Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and do a Traditions and Concepts weekend, like we're doing here, only with Traditions and Concepts. Very studious and use the board and all that, you know. Between when I accepted the invitation and about 3-4 weeks before the event, my granddaughter came up with her very first dance recital. Didn't take 5 minutes for me to cancel me out of that. There's only one first dance recital. And I was needed there by her, by my wife, and by my daughter. And Traditions and Concepts, I'm not the be-all and end-all. I was taught if you can't make it, get a suitable replacement. So we got a replacement that the other guy sponsored anyway. So they didn't need me. Her second dance recital, I was with you. Okay. It isn't that hard to decide, but sometimes it takes, if you're indoctrinated, now what, you got conflict, huh? What's going to happen if I don't show up in Cedar Rapids? You'll probably have a better time without me. My home group does. We were running about 12, 13 people. You know, at 6 in the morning, we don't have much dead weight. And I was on the road for 6 straight weekends and came back, and the group had grown to 22. So it's clear to me that the best way to help my group is to not show up. One part of my mind says that. They were glad I came back. The thing I like about my home group is I'm just a member. They just function fine without me. They function better with me because every member of a group that's missing diminishes the group a little bit. Doesn't hurt them much, but it diminishes them. Anyhow, I can already tell you I'm frustrated because I've already thought of enough things to talk about to get us through till Wednesday, and we got to finish it. So we're going to take a break. He thought he was brought up here to give a long-winded Al-Anon talk. So let's take a break and let him start. Now, smokers, I understand that you need